This morning, we proclaim loud and clear, our God is a God who is in control. Our God is a God who is in control. As we've been studying the book of Daniel the past several weeks, this truth of the sovereignty of God, the fact that he is in control, it's been impressed upon our minds time after time after time. Our God is sovereign. He is in control. No matter what is happening in this world, our God is in control. As we think about our personal lives, whenever we're faced with the most difficult of situations, we can rest assured our God is in control. Even though the most powerful of men or women may be against us, even though they want to do us harm, we can rest assured our God is in control. Even whenever people want to take our lives from us, if that ever would happen, we know that God alone has the power of life and the power of death. No one, no matter how mighty they may be, is able to override God's perfect will. As we think about our personal lives, we know God is in control. As we think about life on the national scale, as we think about this nation as well as the many other nations of this world, we know the same truth applies. God is in control. So there's not a single king or queen, there's not a president, there's not a dictator that ever rises to power apart from God's control. There's never a dictator or a president that is deposed or that leaves office that leaves outside of God's control. We read this in Daniel chapter 2, verses 20 and 21. This is what Daniel proclaimed. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. Daniel recognized God is the one in control in his personal life as well as in the affairs of nations and even how nations interact with nations. So Daniel, a godly prophet of God, recognized the sovereignty of God. He is in control. King Nebuchadnezzar, during Daniel's lifetime, Nebuchadnezzar was probably the most powerful king ever alive. And Nebuchadnezzar, he came to recognize the same truth. We read in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17, Nebuchadnezzar had a vision and words were directed specifically to him. And we read this in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17. The matter is by the decree of the watchers and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will and setteth up over it the basest of men. You see, Nebuchadnezzar was a very proud and arrogant man. And Nebuchadnezzar thought that he was in control, not God. And God showed him how foolish he was. God showed him very clearly how weak and how impotent even the most powerful of men are. And God humbled Nebuchadnezzar. And eventually Nebuchadnezzar came to realize that God is the one in control. He himself confessed in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 35, all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. And he, referring to God, he does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? So here's Nebuchadnezzar, a very powerful king. He came to recognize he's not in control. The God of the universe, he's in control. We recognize that we confess today, God is in control. He's in control of the affairs of my personal life. God is in control of the affairs of the nations of this earth. He's in control of the international affairs of this world as well. Now in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And in his dream he saw the rise and the fall of kingdoms. That was the meaning of his dream, as Nebuchadnezzar saw this great image of various metals. And God revealed to him that the only permanent and eternal kingdom is the kingdom of God. Daniel himself received a vision that communicated the same truth. We have kingdoms rising and we have kingdoms falling, but one day God's kingdom, an eternal kingdom, will rule over all. God's kingdom will never be displaced. It will never be overthrown. And this morning we can rest in the fact, we can be encouraged by the fact that our God is in control no matter what is happening. So whenever we think about countries led by rulers that are despots and are the most wicked men or women possible, God is in control. God is in control whenever his people are treated well. God is in control whenever his people are persecuted and opposed. God is in control. Now this morning we consider another one of Daniel's visions. And this vision once again shows that God is in control. He's in control over the rise of nations and over the fall of nations. He's in control whenever his people are persecuted. And God is the one that sets the limits to the persecution of his people. This morning we can rest assured that we serve a God who is in control of all things. Whether it be my personal life, or the life of this nation, or the life of this world, he is in control. He sets up kings and he takes down kings. And his plan for human history will be fulfilled. I invite you this morning to turn with me to Daniel chapter 8. If you're using one of our pew Bibles, it's on page 1030. Daniel chapter 8, we are reminded of the fact, the wonderful truth, that our God is in control. We read this in verse 1 of Daniel chapter 8. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. Now, as we think about what we looked at last week, Daniel had a vision during the first year of King Belshazzar. Belshazzar was the last king of the Empire of Babylon. And as we think about Daniel's vision last week, as we consider last week what he saw in chapter 7 of Daniel, here God laid out for him his plan for the ages. And in this vision that Daniel had in chapter 7, he was standing in front of a great sea, whether it be the Mediterranean Sea or another sea, we don't know for sure. But this sea was troubled and stirred up by the four winds of heaven. And from the sea came various creatures. The first creature that came up in Daniel chapter 7 was a lion that had eagle's wings. And then eventually that creature was displaced by a bear that had three ribs in his mouth. And then that bear was displaced by a leopard. And this leopard had four wings on its back, and it had four heads on its on top of it. And then there's this terrible fourth creature. This fourth creature had iron teeth and brass claws. It was a beast that destroyed everything that was in its path. And that beast eventually was destroyed by the Ancient of Days, God himself, and the Son of Man, Jesus Christ. Now, these four beasts represented four various kingdoms. We have Babylon, which was represented by the lion with the eagle's wings. We have Medo-Persia, represented by the bear. We have Greece, represented by the leopard. And Rome, represented by that fourth terrible beast. And each of these kingdoms enjoyed a time of prosperity and success. But eventually, each one came to an end. And there will be a day when that fourth kingdom, that revived Roman Empire, will also come to an end. And Jesus Christ will set up his own kingdom. It will be a kingdom enjoyed by us, his saints, and all those who have trusted in Jesus, who have believed God and taken him at his word. But Daniel saw that first vision, the vision we read about in Daniel chapter 7, in the first year of the reign of King Belshazzar. Now we have 2 years later, in the year of 551 BC, Daniel receives another vision. And this vision focuses on two of the nations that were described in chapter 7. And we find specifically how one of those nations treated the people of Daniel, the people of Israel. And Daniel begins to describe this vision in verse 2. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Ulai. So very likely, as we consider where Daniel was at when he received this vision, we think about our geography, and maybe our Middle Eastern geography isn't the best, but he was at this point in time, no doubt, in Babylon. You see the red arrow there, and you may not be able to read the print on the map, but at least you can see the general layout of the land here. Very early on in Daniel's life, he was taken as an exile to the land of Babylon, and he served most of his life in the government of the Babylonians, and he was his residence was there in the city of Babylon. So very possibly, whenever Daniel saw this vision, he was in Babylon. But in his vision, he was transported to another place. And this place is called Shushan or Susa. And this is a fortress city that is in the region of Elam. It's approximately 230 miles to the east of Babylon, about 120 miles north of the Persian Gulf. So that second arrow is the place where Daniel was transported by way of vision. Now this city, the city of Susa, was located between two rivers. We have the Coaspes and the Corprates. And in the junction of these two rivers, there was a fortress that protected the city. And on one side of this fortress was a canal. This canal was built, and it measured some 900 feet wide. And this canal was called the Ulai. And it was by this canal that Daniel was placed. And he saw some incredible sights as he had this vision. So what does he see? We read in verses 3 and 4, as Daniel had been transported by the Spirit of the Lord Now, no doubt he is in spirit as opposed to in his body. We see him, what he sees in this vision, in Daniel chapter 8 and verses 3 and 4. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river, or the canal, a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. Here's Daniel standing before the Ulai Canal, and he notices a ram beside the water. Now, usually when we think of rams, how many horns do they have? They would have two horns, right? And that's the case with this ram that Daniel saw in his vision. It had two high or two very long horns. But what made this ram different than other rams was the fact that one of the horns was longer than the other. And the longer horn was the horn that grew up last. It was the youngest of the horns. Now, this ram was a very domineering ram. It charged to the west, and it charged to the north, and it charged to the south. And anywhere it charged, it had the dominion. It had the victory over any animals that would have opposed it. It was the victor. There is no way that anything could dissuade the ram from what it wanted to do. The ram did whatever it wanted. It became very great. Now, Daniel continued to watch this ram and its pursuits. But as he noticed this ram, he noticed that there was another animal that perhaps was on the horizon, an animal that would be challenging the ram. And we read in verses 5 through 7, "And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth. And he touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between its eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand." Consider what Daniel sees in this vision. He saw this ram that had the dominion over the whole land, over the whole animal empire. He charged various directions, and the ram had dominion. But now Daniel sees another animal. It's a goat, a male goat, a shaggy goat. And as Daniel watches this goat come toward the ram, no doubt it was a long ways away at first. And you'd think it would take a long time for that goat to come and face the ram. But as Daniel watches this goat, he travels across the face of the whole earth, and he comes in a very quick time. As that goat came, no doubt he's running, but he doesn't even touch the ground as he's running. And as he comes to this ram, he's full of anger. He's furious against the ram. Now, when we usually think of goats and horns, do we think of them having horns at all? A lot of times goats today don't have horns necessarily because they kill off the horns. But if they do have horns, how many horns would a goat have? You'd have two, right? But in this case, Daniel saw a goat and just had one horn, a horn coming up between the eyes. Now soon this goat had reached the ram and ran to the ram in a powerful fury. And in his anger, this goat struck the ram and broke its two long horns. And this ram that was so successful in the past, defeating all of its enemies, was powerless in the face of the goat. The goat threw the ram to the ground. It was trampled down, and no one could deliver the ram from the destruction of the goat. Now, as we continue reading, we find verse 8. "Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven." So the ram had enjoyed success for quite a while. Now the goat has defeated the ram, and the goat becomes very great, even greater than the ram. Now there's no doubt that this goat is a very strong creature, but as soon as that goat became very strong, what happened? What happened to its notable horn? Its horn was broken off. It wasn't broken by a conflict with another animal, it was just simply broken off. And in the place of where that one horn grew, four other horns came up. And each one faced a different direction. So we have one horn facing toward the north, one to the south, and one to the east, and one to the west. So quite a strange sight, this goat that once had one horn, but now the horn is broken off and it has four horns. Well, as we continue reading, the vision only gets more intriguing. We come to verses 9 and following. So we have this goat, and the goat now has four horns. We read in verse 9, "And out of one of them, out of one of the horns, came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven. And it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. And it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered." So here's the goat. How many horns does it have now? It has four horns, right? One facing toward each direction. And now from one of the horns on the goat's head, we have a little horn protruding from the one horn. So we have four horns. From one of the horns, there's a little horn. And this little horn starts out small, but very soon it became very great. And it showed dominance toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. And I believe the pleasant land referring to Jerusalem and the land of Judea. And this little horn made itself very great, and it magnified itself. It exalted itself to the prince of the host. I believe it's referring to his exaltation even to the point where he believed that he was God, exalting himself against God, supposing that he is God. This little horn, he dared to take away the daily sacrifice in Jerusalem. He cast down the place of his sanctuary, the temple. And into this little horn's hand was given a host. I believe the host, a large number of people, is referring to the people of Judah. Along with the host of Judah was given the daily sacrifice. It was given because of the transgression or the sin, probably the sin of the Jewish people. So this little horn cast truth to the ground. And in all that this little horn did, it prospered, it had success. So that's the vision that Daniel saw. But what did it all mean? Perhaps you're wondering the same thing. What does it all mean? That's quite the sight. Here, vision, a vision of Daniel that was given to him by God. We have a ram, first of all, that was having success by the Ulai Canal and defeating all of its enemies. And now a goat that destroys the ram, and the goat's one horn is broken off and four horns in its place, and now a little horn coming out of one of the four horns. Well, what does it all mean? Well, Daniel was curious, and Daniel now overhears a conversation. It's no ordinary conversation. We see what he overhears in verses 13 and 14. "Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." Now, usually when we read that word saint, we think of believers like you and I. But the meaning of the word saint is a holy one. As you read in the scriptures, the word behind that word translated saint sometimes refers to people like you and I. Sometimes it refers to the angels of God, those who are set apart to his service, holy ones in heaven. Now, as we look at the context here, I believe that the word translated saint in the King James is referring to a holy one, an angel. So we have an angelic conversation that Daniel is overhearing. And one angel said to another, "How long is it going to last concerning what we saw in this vision concerning the daily sacrifice being taken away, and this transgression of desolation and the temple being desecrated, being trodden underfoot?" And the angel said in response, "Up to 2,300 days, and then the sanctuary will be cleansed." So 6.5 years, the temple would be desecrated. 6.5 years, the Jews would be persecuted by this one figured by the little horn. After that time, we have the temple restored to ritual purity. Well, Daniel's still wondering, well, what's the meaning of this vision? We come to verses 15 and 19. Maybe you're wondering too, what's the meaning of this vision? Well, we find the answer in verses 15 and following. "And it came to pass, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, Understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. And he said, Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be. Now, Daniel is a very wise man of God. He had understanding that was greater than any of the other wise men of Babylon. But Daniel still did not understand what this vision meant. He knew it was an important message. Maybe he knew some of the identifications of the things that he had seen. But what did it all mean, he was wondering. Well, now Daniel sees someone standing before him. This one looks like a man. And then he heard a voice coming between the banks of the Ulai Canal. And this voice directed this man, this one that looked like a man, and this voice directed this one that's called Gabriel to tell Daniel what all this meant. And so Gabriel came near. And as Gabriel came near, what happened to Daniel? Daniel was overcome with fear. He fell down upon his face. He was overwhelmed with awe as he saw this angel in his glory. And Gabriel said, "Understand, O son of man." Gabriel addressing Daniel as a mortal, as a mere human. And Gabriel was wanting to explain to Daniel all the things that he had seen and heard. Now, whether Daniel heard those words of Gabriel, we don't know, because as we continue reading down through the text, we realize that Daniel had fallen into a deep sleep. He's just overcome with all that he had seen and being faced with this angel, Gabriel, no doubt in all of his glory. So he had fallen into an unconscious state. What does Gabriel do? Just with a touch of a hand, Daniel wakes up and he's set up on his feet. And Gabriel tells Daniel, this is what's going to happen at the last time of the indignation. This is going to be at the end. The end would be at the time appointed. Gabriel said, "Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed, the end shall be." Now, we've looked at a lot of verses so far, and we need to maybe just pause a little bit and stand back and kind of get a big picture. And what's a big idea going on here? Well, who is the one that appoints times? Who is the one that sets the beginning and the end? God is the one that appoints the beginning and the end and everything in between. And so whenever Gabriel told Daniel, "Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed, the end shall be." Who is the one that sets the time? The appointed time? God is the one that sets the appointed time. God is in control of history, and his plan will be fulfilled. Now, Gabriel spoke about the time of the indignation in the latter time, or the latter end of the time of indignation. So what is this time of indignation, and whose indignation is it? And I believe when Gabriel speaks of this time of indignation, it's talking about God's indignation toward his people Israel. And why was God indignant at his people Israel? What makes God angry in his holiness? Sin does, doesn't it? In Israel, from very early on in its existence, had refused to follow God. Israel had instead worshipped false gods, false idols. They had gone astray. They had a stiff neck, and they were intent in being wicked and stubborn. The time of God's indignation against Israel, we can really focus a time of beginning at that time of indignation whenever the nation of Assyria came against Israel. Remember how Assyria conquered the northern 10 tribes of Israel? And when Assyria conquered Israel, Assyria was used as the rod of God's indignation. We read in Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 5, "O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger and the staff in their hand is mine indignation." So with the Assyrian captivity, I believe we have the beginning of this time of indignation. Now, it didn't take very long before Judah was also encountering a severe enemy. And that enemy was called Babylon. And Babylon eventually conquered Judah and Jerusalem. And for 70 years, the Judeans were in exile. That time of Babylonian exile was a time of God's indignation against Israel. We read this in Zechariah chapter 1 and verse 12. "Then the angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah, against which thou hast had indignation these 70 years? So the 70 years that Israel, the Jews, were in Babylon, God's indignation was against them because of their sin. So we can identify the beginning of God's indignation against his people with the time of the Assyrian captivity, the Assyrian conquest of Israel. His indignation would continue on through the Babylonian Empire, and through the Medo-Persian Empire and the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire. During all those times, Israel was under subjugation of these foreign nations. During this time, Israel, by and large, was still in rebellion against God. Gabriel tells Daniel this vision that he saw related to the latter end of this time of God's indignation against his people Israel. Now, after saying that, Gabriel goes on to explain the meaning of the vision. So, what animal did Daniel see first in his vision? He saw a ram, right? So what's the significance of the ram? Look at verse 20. The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. So the first animal Daniel saw in this vision by the Ulai Canal was a ram. Now it had two horns. What was unique about the horns? One horn was longer than the other, right? So whenever we think about the Medo-Persia Empire, it was a confederation of two kingdoms to a large extent. We have Media, which existed as a powerful empire or kingdom for quite a long time, even before Persia came on the scene. But Persia eventually had dominion over Media, and they joined together, and Persia became the dominant part of the Medo-Persian Empire. So we have the two horns. One is longer than the other, so the Persians are more dominant than the Medes. So it was this ram representing the Medo-Persians that had great dominance throughout the world of its day. It went various directions, and it had the victory. It's interesting, as you study out the Medo-Persian Empire, the guardian spirit of this empire was portrayed as a ram. We have the Persian king. Oftentimes he would wear a metal helmet, and it resembled the head of a ram whenever he was at the head of its army. So for a number of years, the Medo-Persian Empire held sway over the civilized world. Any opposition against it was put down. So the armies of Medo-Persia traveled from the east, and it conquered peoples in the west, and to the north, and to the south. So Medo-Persia, for quite a long time, was the dominant force in the world of that day. But then it was challenged by the goat. Gabriel tells us about that goat in verse 21. And the rough goat is the king of Grisha, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. So Daniel, as he was looking at that ram, the ram was destroyed by a goat, and the goat had one horn between its eyes. Gabriel tells Daniel that single horn is the first king of the empire. The notable king is none other than Alexander the Great. If we'd study out history, and there's a lot we could share with you about this empire of Greece, but at 22 years of age, we have Alexander the Great beginning his campaign against the Medo-Persian Empire. Within 3 years' time, after three major campaigns against Medo-Persia, he had defeated that mighty empire. Very quickly, Alexander the Great defeated the Medo-Persians and many other nations as well. Now, what did Daniel see? He saw that goat with a single horn, but what happened to the horn? It got broken off. So just as that single horn was broken off, Alexander the Great died at the age of 32 years. So just a very young man, Alexander the Great died. He didn't die in battle. He didn't die because of the assassination of an enemy. No, he died of other causes that could not be traced to his enemies. So after his death, there are four generals that divided up his empire. And none of these generals would have the same dominance as that Alexander the Great had. So we look at verse 22. Now that being broken, the single horn, whereas four stood up for it, for a kingdom shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. So eventually there are four generals that take possession of the kingdom. They divide it up amongst themselves. It took a number of years as they fought back and forth with one another. And so eventually this is how it worked out. We have Ptolemy. He took Egypt, so we have on our map here, I circled Egypt with that red circle. He also took the island of Cyprus and the area of Palestine. That was Ptolemy. We have Seleucus. He took Syria, so now we have this blue circle, the area of Syria, Babylonia, and the southern part of Asia Minor, and also the Iranian plateau. We have Lysimachus. He took Thrace and the western part of Asia Minor, so we have this blackish-colored circle. Then we have Cassander. He took Macedonia and Greece proper, so we have this yellowish circle. So we have a division of the Grecian Empire into four areas. So that goat with the single horn now becomes a goat with four horns. And from one of these horns came a little horn, a horn that would become very great in power, a horn that would succeed in whatever he put his mind to. Well, what is the meaning of this little horn? Look at verses 23 through 25. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. The little horn is Antiochus IV, also known as Antiochus Epiphanes. He would be the eighth ruler of the Seleucid division of the Greek Empire. So he makes his appearance at the end of the Grecian Empire. He's not a rightful heir to the throne. He gained that position by bribery and through flattery. But once Antiochus IV became king, he attacked Egypt to the south. He attacked Armenia and Elymais to the east. He was so bold as to try to influence the religious practices of the Jews in Palestine. Earlier in this passage, we read about how the little horn cast some of the stars to the ground. He trampled upon them. He trampled upon the people of Israel. He was given the host. He was given the daily sacrifice. The authority of Israel's people and even the goings-on of the temple was put into Antiochus' authority. So the stars and the host, they were given to Antiochus, no doubt referring to the Jews. And you read through history, Antiochus performed many atrocities against the Jewish people. He forbade them to practice the law, and if they did practice the law, they'd be killed. So he forbade them from worshiping God and having the daily sacrifices. He told them to profane the Sabbath. He told them to offer unclean animals as sacrifices, not to circumcise their children. He destroyed copies of the law. So Antiochus IV, he did everything he could against the people of Israel, against the Jews. He did everything to exalt himself against the one true and living God. See, Antiochus opposed the true God. He set himself up as equal to God. He proclaimed himself as God made manifest. He profaned the temple. He stopped the daily sacrifice. He threw God's truth, the law, to the ground. He trampled upon it. Antiochus desecrated the temple for a long period of time, from 171 to 165 BC. We have the desecration of the temple. On December the 25th, 165, the temple was restored. The sacrifices began again. Earlier, remember the question that the angel had asked? How long is this going to take place? It was 2,300 days, 6.5 years. That amount of time, Antiochus was given authority from God to persecute God's people, to destroy many of the Jews, to wreak havoc on the temple and its practices, to desecrate it in the worst possible way. So throughout Antiochus's rule, he used great deceit to fulfill his plans. He proclaimed peace, but instead, he slaughtered people. He looted the treasures of Jerusalem. He stood up against God, and for a time, for those 2,300 days, he was able to do as he pleased. He had success from an earthly point of view. But remember, who is the one that appoints times? It's God. So God appointed the time when Antiochus would be able to persecute his people, the Jews. God appointed the time when Antiochus would die. And we read about this little horn. He would be broken off without human action. He died of causes that are not related to his enemies. Antiochus's time was set by God. This is what Daniel saw. This is what was explained to him by Gabriel. And what was explained to him was true. Look at verse 26. And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Therefore shut up thou the vision, for it shall be for many days. So this vision of these 2,300 days, 6.5 years of persecution against Israel, this would come to pass. Gabriel emphasized this to Daniel. This is true. You need to preserve this message. This little horn would come to power. It would wreak havoc against his people, the Jews. Antiochus would set himself up against the true God, but his reign of terror would have an end. Gabriel says, this vision needs to be shut up. It needs to be preserved until the day of its fulfillment. So Daniel recorded it in writing. He shut it up. He sealed it so so that it would be preserved. Now, 380 years after Daniel saw this vision, the events of the vision came to pass. What God proclaimed as yet future came to pass in history. Now, Daniel had seen an incredible vision. He had been told its significance by Gabriel, the holy angel of God. God had chosen to reveal to Daniel what happens in the future among nations. Daniel came to realize afresh, God is the one in control. God is the one in control and put the Medes and the Persians in power. He's the one that put the Grecians in power. He's later the one who had set the Romans in power instead. God is in control when things are going well for his people. God is in control when things are very hard for his people. Now, what Daniel experienced seeing this vision and encountering Gabriel, that was a very hard experience for him, a very difficult time, because we read in verse 27, "And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it." So this vision was so powerful, so awe-inspiring, to see what God would do yet in the future, to come in contact with an angel of God in his glory. That was so overwhelming to Daniel that he ended up fainting and losing his consciousness. He was sick for several days, but then he finally recovered and went back to work for the king's business. But all throughout the time, he was astonished at what he had seen and what God had revealed to him. And none but him understood some of the things that he had seen. Now we today, as we consider this passage, maybe you're astounded at this vision as well. Maybe you're a little bit overwhelmed at the things that we've seen. But there's no doubt that God is in control. This vision is an incredible vision. It's difficult to understand in many ways. But it speaks about events that were in the future for Daniel. But for us, looking back, these are events that have been fulfilled in the past. Not many of us are all that familiar with the Medo-Persian Empire or the Empire of Greece. But if we glean nothing else from this chapter, and there's many things to glean from it, let us remember the truth. Let's put it to heart. God is in control of human history. God has a perfect plan, and his plan will be fulfilled. So God is in control of our personal affairs. He's in control of our nation's affairs. He's in control of international affairs. So whenever we turn on the TV and we watch the news, a lot of the news is bad, right? Who's in control of all the bad things happening, whether it's in this nation or on the international scale? God is in control. Whenever we read the paper or whenever we scan the news on our phones, we see all these headlines. We see all these things going on in the world. Let us remember, God is in control. Whenever we have nations waging war against nations, whenever we have terrorists acting out against even our own people, whenever we have a ruler turning against his own people, or a ruler slaughtering hundreds upon hundreds or even thousands of people, remember, God is still in control. And God is the one who sets times and seasons, and eventually God's kingdom will come to this earth, and God is going to rule in perfect peace. And everybody that comes against him is going to be put down. Whenever our own president, whenever our Congress, whenever our courts make decisions that are either good or bad, remember, God is in control. As we think about our own lives, there are times when we have extreme hardship. We need to know that God is in control. God's plan is perfect. Even when we don't realize why God is doing the things that he does. So whenever we have loved ones, whether it be family members or we have friends, whenever they get sick, whenever they pass away, we need to remember God is in control. Whenever we lose our job, if we lose our house or our apartment, remember God is in control. He knows what is best. We have to trust him. Our God reigns. Our God is sovereign. He rules on this earth. He rules in heaven above, and we need to trust him. Daniel saw an incredible vision, a vision that related specifically to his people, the Jews. And he saw some terrible things that would happen to his Jewish people. But all through this, God was showing Daniel, I am in control. My will be done. Trust in me. Let us trust in God today, knowing that he is the one that declares the beginning and the end and everything in between. Let us trust him, the one who is in control of all.